And now, live from Jerusalem, you're listening to Israel Inspired Radio. Here are your hosts, Rabbis Ari Abramowitz and Jeremy Gimpel.
Shalom, everyone. Welcome back to Israel Inspired on the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com. This is Jeremy Gimpel. I'm here with Rabbi Ari Abramowitz, and we have a lot to talk about. Ari, how's life?
Life is good. What's up?
Things are amazing. You know, it's a weird time now being in this place at the headquarters as we commemorate Rabbi Akiva's students. My beard is longer than it's been in a long time. I'm looking quite disheveled now because from the day after Passover until Lag BaOmer, until the 33rd day of the Omer, we don't shave and we don't get haircuts.
It's just interesting that you sort of frame that as disheveled. Disheveled. So you're saying the great sages of Israel have been disheveled throughout Jewish history?
During this time period, we're a little bit disheveled looking.
No, it's only new that we shave our beards at all and trim our beards down, and it's Western framing and perspective that's causing you to cause right. that. David's men had to shave off half their beards. He said, stay home until your beards grow back.
Right.
Disheveled is not having a beard.
No, but I look disheveled because I keep it trimmed and I cut off some of it, and some of it is growing. It's like imbalanced. It looks unkept. If I had a long, flowing, beautiful, holy beard, that would be one thing. But because I sort of have this Western name, Jeremy, instead of Yirmiyahu, and I have like this Western beard instead of like a biblical beard, I look disheveled now because it's not well kept.
That's the reason the Jews had to go on a 40-year circuitous route out of Egypt, because it's one thing to take the Jew out of Egypt, it's another thing to take the Egypt out of the Jew. And I feel like you're really fessing up to that we each have some of that exile within us.
Thank you for pointing my exile out.
You got it.
Anyway, so we're here commemorating the death of Rabbi Akiva's students, and we're in a place that we know almost for sure Rabbi Akiva and his men lived. They hid from the Romans. And we have a cave right here, right off our headquarters. That's maybe a 7-minute walk. And it's big and it's beautiful and it's historic and it's epic. And there are escape tunnels that the archaeologists say date back to Bar Kokhba and his men. And who knows what other people were there. But every time that I go there, and especially during this time period, something kind of awakens within me that I feel like the struggle continues. Even though we lost that battle, we didn't lose the war. And now it's like the next ma'aracha. I don't know how you would say that in English, but like the next battle.
Phase.
We're like at the next battle front now. We're once again back in Judea. We're once again back in this cave. And we're once again fighting against odds that are just insurmountable. The European Union, the foreign minister of Germany just came to Israel. And he wanted to meet with Shovrim Shtika or Betzelem, one of these quote-unquote left-wing organizations. And when I say left-wing, someone could think that left-wing means...
It's just on the spectrum.
Liberal, they just want to have peace. No, left-wing in Israel, what left-wing means, these type of organizations, means that they are radical surrenderists. They want to surrender to the Hamas. They want to weaken the IDF. They would want us to lose. They want to actually
destroy Israel. They don't want to have a Jewish state of Israel.
They want to destroy Israel, period. That's what left wing means. And you know what? It's funny, but the left wing in America, the real radical left wings in America, they want to destroy America
as
well.
Yeah, leftism is a global ideology of disconnection.
So these organizations, don't want to get lost on the whole philosophy of it all, but I think people understand what we're talking about. We're talking about the Kukurikus on the left. And so the foreign minister of Germany came to Israel, and on right around Holocaust Memorial Day, he set up a meeting with one of these organizations that's hell-bent on destroying Israel. They find false cases against IDF soldiers. The IDF is the most moral army in the world, bar none. And they try to point them out as war criminals to weaken the IDF, to strengthen the Hamas in order to destroy Israel. And the foreign minister of Germany, right around Holocaust Memorial Day, set up a meeting with this organization that's hell-bent on destroying Israel. Probably Germany or the European Union funds these organizations. And I think that it's still unclear where their funding comes from. But it makes sense that if the foreign minister of that country is meeting them, they have nice ties. But Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said, I don't want you to meet with them. They are destroying our country. They are weakening our position here against jihad. And your meeting with them is hurting the security and safety of Israeli civilians. And if you meet with them, I'm not going to meet with you. And I was like, good for Bibi Netanyahu for doing that.
No, not good for saying it. Good for following through.
Following through. And then what happened was, I couldn't believe it. Because I saw the story unfolding, the foreign minister of Germany met against the prime minister's wishes with the organization hell-bent on destroying Israel. And then Netanyahu was like, all right, fair enough. Bye. I'm not meeting you anymore. And then the foreign minister of Germany went home, kind of tail between his legs. And there was two reactions in Israel that I found fascinating. The vast majority of Israelis were like, go Netanyahu, show those Germans, the descendants of Nazis, something else. They can't just kick around Jews anymore. You're going to go against our will. You're not going to meet with us. And now it's like a little bit of self-respect, not enough in my opinion, but at least there's now an inkling of a little bit of Jewish pride. And then there was leftist voices, not from the radical left this time, from sort of the parv left. And they said, well, Germany is a very important country. We shouldn't alienate their foreign minister. That foreign minister, he may be the next prime minister of Germany. We should try to keep those relations as warm as we can. And what that weak, faithless Jew Herzog is saying by saying that is, how do you want to know how to destroy your relationship with Germany? Let them walk all over you.
Yeah.
The only way to maintain that relationship is to actually fight for our rights, to fight for our freedom. And we're right back at Rabbi Akiva again. And if the Jews can just tap into that spirit of the fighters of Rabbi Akiva and know that this is our right to be in this land, then it makes this whole time period a little bit more
important. I'll tell you, just the other day, you brought over this guy that cleans your house every now and then. Well, I don't know, maybe he comes for a few hours every couple of weeks over there. But his name is Ahmad, and he's from an Arab village in the area, Wadi Nis. And you brought him out to the headquarters, and you brought him here, and he was helping me out here. We were, like, cleaning the place together and putting something together, very good at building. And you know, as he came out to me, and he's like, aren't you afraid? He says, he asked me if I'm afraid, and I said, Imad, afraid of what? Like, getting him to have to say of the Arabs, you know, because he is an Arab himself. And I said, Imad, afraid of what? And he's like, you know, aren't you afraid? And it just happened to be that before he came, out of nowhere, the mezuzah fell off of the door here in the headquarters. So I took the mezuzah, I put it as a fixing under it. When he asked me that question, I said, afraid of what? And then I said, here, come with me, Ahmad. And I put double-sided tape there, and I went and I put the mezuzah on the door, and I said, this is why I'm not afraid, Ahmad, because Hashem, Elohim, is with me. He's like, amen. You know, he was really. So then I took him and I drove him all the way into his Arab village. You've, I think, done that before.
Yep.
I did it. It was late at night and I drove him deep into his village. And when I got in front of his house, all of these kids and people started gathering around the car. Right now, I had Asai, my dog, in the back. I had a gun. And I just like rolled down the window, smiled and waved. And then a lot of them were just smiling and waving back. You know, and then I came back and it was a real experience. I think that. It's, you know, Herzog and people like that, the Israeli left, a lot of their motivation is coming from fear and pragmatism. But when we just really let that fear go, even just as an experiment, just for a little bit, I think a lot of the hostility and anger and confusion that we as a nation are facing, because it makes sense for us to have fear. We are, you know, vastly outnumbered.
Okay, vastly outnumbered, vastly outnumbered. No question. A lot of fear, a lot of confusion. But there's also something that people of small mind and small faith sort of look to the world and say, well, they're all doing that. If they all believe that, then we must be wrong. I mean, it's sort of like the truth is in the numbers kind of thing. And inherently, the Jews are always going to lose that battle because the truth is not with the numbers. The Torah itself says that he chose Israel because we were the fewest of all nations and not the most of all nations. And just because there's a lot of Chinese people in the world doesn't mean that Chinese theology is necessarily true. And just because there's a billion Muslims or a billion Christians doesn't mean that they're true. Numbers has absolutely nothing to do with it. And then I look now at the United Nations. Did you hear the newest thing? The newest thing is that Saudi Arabia, who ranks 134 out of 145 countries. We're talking now about like below the 10th percentile of as bad as you can get with gender equality, was elected to head the UN Human Rights Council for Women. So why do we at all care what the nations of the world say when they are so obviously deranged, demented, and immoral? Why would we take any stock? Because these United Nations, they are the representation of the leadership of all of the nations. For example, Nikki Haley, she might as well be the president of the United States as far as I'm concerned. She's the best U.S. ambassador to the United Nations that I ever remember. She has her head on her shoulders. She is fantastic. Do you know why she is fantastic and the last ambassador was kind of a loser? Because Trump elected her to be the ambassador, meaning each one of these representations at the United Nations, each one of them, it represents the actual ideology and thought process of these nations. And when you see that the United Nations would make such an insane decision to put Saudi Arabia as the head of the Women's Human Rights Commission, you have to start really asking yourself, why do we care at all what they think? Not only that, we also know the world goes mad. Just 70 years ago, Europe went mad as far as the Jews concerned, and they all either facilitated Nazism, joined Nazism, and helped exterminate 6 million Jews. So we already know from our history that the world is not a place that the moral compass is very strong. It's not a place where the direction is necessarily the right direction. Israel, and now actually Netanyahu, like, took a step in the right direction, but we really have to step more and more into that leadership position, saying we are the moral compass of the world, and the way we deal with jihad is moral and true. And this organization, B'Tselem or B'Shovrim Shtika or whoever they are, they need to be outlawed, maybe even arrested. Just they're traitors.
Yeah, I don't know that we need to say we are the moral compass of the world. I think we just need to be it. Just do it. Not to say it. If we do it, our actions will speak much louder than our words. My only fear is if we start saying that, but we continue with so much of our policies, which are reactive and pragmatic and not necessarily the right and the true thing to do. Like with Syria, the gas attack that Syria did on their own citizens, I think that would have been a real opportunity for Israel to put their foot down and say, this is just not, after what we've been through in Nazi Germany, what we know is right and true and moral, we cannot sit by and watch these civilians gassed by Assad, and we attack Assad.
I'm sorry, I just disagree with you.
Okay, that's legitimate.
I'm legitimate. I'm allowed to disagree with you. It makes the show interesting. I'll tell you why I disagree with you.
It makes it interesting, but it's always embarrassing for you at the end when you have to start doing all this.
I'll just tell you
logic.
What my opinion is, because I was thinking, I was like, yeah, it's what's good about the Syrian attack from Trump was that Trump had a red line. Red line was no chemical warfare. Barack Obama and John Kerry, they put 17 different red lines with different colors of pink in the middle, and like no one cared what they said. No one had any concern for them. No one feared them. No one respected them. And the world just did whatever they wanted. Trump, without even like questioning it, chemicals were used. You're going to get bombed. End of story. But if we think about it in a moral sense, what would be worse? For him to slaughter a million people with bullets? Or 100 people with gas. Gas, that's it. Now
we're right, no, I agree
the
with you.
Real
death is
moral
death.
Compass.
Death is death.
Exactly. Israel, if we think Assad is doing something immoral, should do whatever it needs to do to stop the injustice and free the people that are enslaved by that dictator, as well as we should do
despite
in Assad.
Despite the fact that the people that we're going to free, most of them want us wiped off the map as well. But that's not the issue. Whether they're what we're not taking polls of the victims of Assad's regime. The point is he slaughtering defenseless people? Then we should. And what would the world say? Finally, it would be us coming and attacking Assad, and not for our own self-interest and our own defense, but because we are moral leaders in the world. I think that would be a fundamental shift.
Can I tell you what I think needs to happen next time? Next time Trump does a big bomb, because he loves the big bombs. He's such a Hollywood guy. You know, he loves, like, the mother of all bombs and the big explosions. It was just like one bomb. Like, you know, he just loves the spectacle of it all. He's such
Moab,
a showman.
Yeah, but
he's just a showman.
Killed, what, 30
Bottom
people?
Line is, well, what it did was it realigned the world. Now the whole world, there's like a new world order, and Trump is at the top at this point.
What?
That's what I think. Definitely he's realigned it better than Obama and Kerry did.
That's
not the point. What I'm saying is the next time Trump does another kind of bomb stunt, that's what they call it. We'll call it a stunt, like another publicity stunt with his bombs. At the same exact day, the Israeli Air Force needs to be ready And as soon as the bomb goes off in Afghanistan or Syria or wherever he does it, immediately we go and we just floor. We just like bring it to rubbles, the Hamas headquarters in Gaza. And it will look, first of all, the news will talk about the mother of all bombs because Donald Trump has better ratings than Israel. The second point is it will almost look as if it was coordinated with America and it's like a joint effort to destroy jihad. And so if we do it at the same time as Trump does it, we'll be able to kill two birds with one stone. We'll get the world off our back, and we'll actually eliminate the Hamas.
Okay, for those of you out there that think I'm rude to Jeremy, you should understand the psychology of a Jew, that we enjoy the debate. So as I'm engaging him in debate, because he's a great Jew, he enjoys that. You talk about pragmatism, that, you know, we're too pragmatic, and then you're like, oh, let's utilize his bombing to do our own bombing, then the world, and we'll position it. What is with all this need to spin and position? Why? If we'll do it, we'll do it. Why does it need to be done like that? So it looks like it's coordinated. Why are we trying to make people feel like it's coordinated if it's not? Are we just,
I'm saying,
do we have a basic, simple truth?
Yeah. I'm saying, like, even though we're right, let's do it in the smartest way possible. And that's a really good way to do it.
To make people think that it's coordinated?
No, just if you do it at the same time, because what happens? What is the world? The world wakes up in the morning and turns on the TV. But what are the people that are making the TV doing? CNN gets together and like, well, folks, it's an editorial meeting. What are we going to talk about today? What are the news stories of the day? And they're what are we going to talk about? And they need to create news stories. In comes the mother of all bombs in Afghanistan. We're going to talk about that for the next at least 3 days. And then you know what's going to happen? Boop, something else is going to happen. The World Cup. It's now it's the playoffs in the NBA. And people are going to talk about new things that are happening all the time. And what I'm saying is that Israel is constantly a source of good news. They'll always find new news stories about Israel. But if Israel's able to do what it needs to do when there's a bigger news story that's out there, like a Trump bombing Afghanistan, that will be the best time that Israel will be able to do what it needs to do because it's the right thing to do. But it will also avoid all of the negative pushback because it's not like we're going to solve the problem of anti-Semitism and the Jew hatred in Europe and in CNN, in BBC, etc. So I'm saying, how do we do what's right and just do it in the smartest way possible?
Okay.
I want you to know Netanyahu listens to these shows and he's acted multiple times based on our hatzaot. How do you say hatzaot?
Hatzaot advice?
Advice.
Okay, I also want to let you know that Ayatollah Khomeini's grandson Hassan Khomeini listens to this show.
That's our
he
listener.
He sent me an email.
Anyways, I was always wondering who was that one listener in Iran.
Could we shift gears for a second?
Well, can I just say one more thing?
Yeah, sure, of course.
Americans are weird. I'm just letting you know that. The more I encounter Americans nowadays, the more weird they become. I was just because I get all my news on Twitter, and I'm like connected to all the different.
You know, you're like the guy that calls his wife and says, things are insane. Everybody is driving the wrong way on this one-way street. And he's actually the guy. Could it be that you're projecting your own increasing aberration?
You know what? I'm going to show you the tweet right now, and then you tell me Americans are not weird. Read this out loud. Read it out loud.
Nordstrom sells jeans with fake mud on them.
For how much?
$425.
So some company...
Let me tell you, they're not selling it. No. They're not selling it. I ordered it, and they're out of stock.
I want you to know they're out of stock because so many Americans want to pay $425 for jeans that have mud on them.
I think it's insulting to the actual worker people that have mud on their jeans.
Can you imagine what this is? Americans are just weird. I just put that. I tweeted and I said, Americans are weird. And people really responded. Yep, pretty much. The American society has lost its way so much that they would waste money.
That's okay. What's so different about this? When I was a kid, they're selling jeans that have holes in them.
Holes on them is one thing.
Why?
Well,
why?
First of all, when they had holes in them, it wasn't $425.
It certainly was.
It's embarrassing. The dude who made this is laughing his tush off. He's like, $425 for mud on the jeans. It's like, how brilliant could he have to be? The jeans cost him $3 by some sweatshop in China, and they're selling it for $425 because it has mud on them for Americans.
Good for them.
Come on, man. That is weird.
Okay, I don't think you could say America. Okay, point made.
Whoever's buying that is weird.
Speaking of weird Americans, my parents made Aliyah this morning.
Mazel tov.
Yeah, very, very big deal for my family. My parents made Aliyah this morning. We went to the airport. I was there. Picked up my sister at 6 o'clock. I'm there at 7. They walked out the door at 10 a.m. after 3 hours of us waiting, and it was an explosion of joy.
Wow.
I mean, my nieces were there, my nephews were there, my cousins were there. We had signs, we had t-shirts printed up with their pictures on it. And right there, it wasn't a charter flight like Nefesh B'Nefesh usually has where the whole flight is done. So there's just a little group of them on the plane that were making Aliyah, and we just danced there at the airport. And I just felt like, you know, it's the culmination of so much dreaming and so much hoping and so much praying. All the kids are here already, and they're like the captains, the last one to jump ship. And they finally jumped ship, and they're here on that one-way ticket. And now their tickets go, you know, there to America and back.
Wow.
It was just so foundationally very exciting for our family. So I thought that that would be something we could celebrate together, especially because of all the things you had on their lift. Right. I mean, the drum set, you need to send anything to Israel? Yeah, drum set, an ATV, a helicopter, like... Anyways, yeah, so that's been good. Other news from the headquarters, the Land of Israel headquarters. Don't remember if we've talked about this yet, but we traded two young sheep for a very large, massive bull-like sheep. I named him Shwarma, but everybody else named him Gaddafi. And he's got... They have a bell around his neck now because our farmhand shepherd guy that helps us around here, he has been knocked down, thrown to the ground. I saw it myself by this sheep that just plunges at him and slams into him, throwing this guy.
Now, people
across
that don't
the
understand
room.
Sheep are the most docile, sweet animals. They just follow you. They're
yeah,
just like
going
nice.
To sheep like sheep to the slaughter. There's a reason.
Like,
there's that.
He's like a buffalo bull.
He's a buffalo bull. That's exactly like what he is. But
beautiful.
He's a sheep,
and
he's massive, and he's a bully. So we tied this bell to his neck, so you can always tell where he is, so he can't sneak up behind you and knock you down. So that is. Good news from the Land of Israel headquarters.
I got good news from all of Israel. I have good news for all of Israel. You ready for this? Bloomberg ranks Israel's third most stable economy. Now imagine where
Bloomberg
Israel
is
would
a
be.
Jew, though.
No, but it's a magazine,
know,
you weirdo.
I'm kidding.
So imagine where the world would be if the world stopped funding these terrorist organizations like the Palestinian Authority and the Hamas and giving them billions of dollars to build more tunnels and to kill us even. Meaning the third most stable economy in the world. That is a big deal. Israel is such a young country. We're about to celebrate 69 years. We're like so, so young. And we're the third most stable economy in the world with both hands tied behind our backs, surrounded by Muslim terrorists, infiltrated by Muslim terrorists already within our borders. And like we are just on a tear to see how much we've grown in just 69 years.
Yeah, it reminds me of the hitchhiking issue here in Israel. You know, I don't think I would put my money that there's no country in the world with the hitchhiking culture that Israel has, where you if you got room in your car, you pick people up, you hitchhike. And this is with the danger of hitchhiking, where every now and then. It's, you know, they dress up as ultra-Orthodox and they pick up someone hitchhiking and they kill them in the car. If it wasn't for that fear of terrorists, even though we're the number one hitchhiking country in the world, we would be even so far beyond that.
Yeah,
it's like such an exciting, dynamic place to be here in Israel. It's when you say Americans are weird, I don't think it's because of jeans with fake mud on them. I think it's because why would an American Jew not want to come and cast his lot here with Israel? Life is just so rich and it's so short. What are we hedging our bets about?
Well, I'll tell you, I think that a lot of the news about the terror and the things is a real deterrent for people. You know, there was a British student who was murdered in Jerusalem. Did you hear about that story?
Yeah, on the bus.
On the bus. And it made a real brouhaha all over England. Why? Because that terrorist family now, because everyone who kills a Jew or a Christian, in the name of jihad, the Palestinian Authority pays their family £800 a month, or about $1,000 a month. So what happened now is that the terrorist who murdered this British Christian student, that family is now getting paid about $1,000 a month. But what's so incredible is that the UK just last year gave the Palestinian Authority £25 million. So the UK is paying the Palestinian Authority to kill their own British student that came to learn here. And when the British people understood that their tax money is going to pay a terrorist organization that's killing their own civilians, it really created a stir all over England. I mean, it was all over social media, specifically coming from England. Why is our tax money going to pay the Palestinian Authority? They're using it that you killed a British woman, and they've been paying off terrorists over and over again. I mean, $1 billion, I think, goes now to terrorist families. Most of the time, they killed Jews. This time it happened to
There's
be.
There's no way they can know she wasn't a Jew.
Yeah, they didn't know. They thought she was a Jew.
Women don't wear a yarmulke.
They knew that she wasn't a Muslim, and they don't really care. I mean, obviously they like extra points if you get a Jew. But killing a Christian, it's the same money. You'll get $1,000 if you kill a Christian. That's no problem. Jihad wants to kill Jews and Christians, and they're pretty much the same. There's an extra satisfaction when you kill a Jew. But money is money. And all of a sudden, UK was like in a storm about the fact that they're funding this terrorist organization called the Palestinian Authority. And it was just fascinating to me that, like, they've been funding them for years and no one cared at all. And then this, you know, very unfortunate case happened, and it sort of woke the world up. They went back to sleep already, the people in England. They've already forgotten about it. Now their tax money is still going to the Palestinian Authority. But at least for those few days, they like woke up to the insanity of what the world is doing by funding the Palestinian Authority or funding the humanitarian quote unquote needs of the Hamas. And we, again, just need to do what's right.
Yeah, the more I think about it, the simpler it really is. I was just speaking, you know, I've spoken to a number of Christian groups lately. For some reason, it's been Christian group after Christian group. And, you know, I was talking to this group. It was their first night in Israel on their first trip in Israel. And they're coming here and they have sort of they see the Israel-Palestinian conflict through a political prism, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm here speaking to them spiritually. And I say, you know, as a Jew, I'm realizing more and more that this conflict we're having, the Arab-Israeli conflict, is not going to be solved. It's only going to be transcended. When we both realize that the land doesn't belong to us, but that we belong to the land, and we are sovereign over it right now as the Jewish people, and we say to them, listen, if you want to live here as residents of this country that have the rights and the privileges that all of us have, you shouldn't be able to dictate the nature of the country. You should, but if you want to live here and be our friends, wonderful. But if you want to destroy us and kill us, throw them out of the country. It's such a simple equation. It doesn't need to be complicated. We're going through this right now also with the farm and all of these issues we're having. We're realizing the simplest truth is often really it feels like it has God's signature on it.
Yeah.
You know, it's only when we're afraid of what the simple truth is that we start to overcomplicate things.
Yeah. To me, all of these challenges that we're facing today fit perfectly in with the Torah portion that we're reading almost as always. Somehow, the message that I'm able to glean from that week's Torah portion is always so relevant for my own personal life, for our national experience as a nation, and very often for the world. But in this week's Torah portion, we talk a lot about tzarat. We talk about leprosy. And there was a midrash that I never understood until literally this week when I studied it. And the midrash says that, you know, the way that tzarat, the way that leprosy, although leprosy is a different thing, but that's how it's usually translated. Tzarat is really...
It's not leprosy, but
it's
okay.
Not leprosy, because leprosy doesn't appear on your house. But the way that tzarat appears first is it appears on your house. There's like a supernatural thing that manifests itself on the bricks of your home. And if you continue speaking Lashon Hara, according to the sages of Israel, then it gets even closer to you and it then appears on your clothes. And if you still don't do tshuva, then it actually appears on your skin. And eventually you're like, that's it. You just have to be removed from the camp. Everyone will know.
You need a timeout.
You need a timeout. And, you know, the Rambam says, it's like, Ot vepele hayab Israel kedei lehasiran milashon hara, that this thing called tzarat, what they call leprosy, was simply a marvel, a wonder, a miracle, in order to kind of guide the Jewish people towards a society that would be godly. And the worst thing a society can do is to speak evil about each other, to speak evil at all. And what's interesting is that America is so good at tapping into the vices, tapping into the Yetzer Hara, tapping into like really what's not allowed by the Torah. And you go to the, you know, the newspaper stand and there's entire industries, billion-dollar industries, where the entire magazine is just gossip about famous people. The whole thing. And it feeds in to that evil inclination that we have of loving to gossip about people. And the Torah is saying, no, you're not supposed to do that. And if you do that, it's going to hit your home. And after your home, it's going to hit your clothes. And after it hits your clothes, it's going to hit your skin. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe brings a beautiful Torah on this idea. Because, you know, the Kohen needs to come. And then he needs to tell you, like, what you have. Is this tzarat? Is it not tzarat? And he said, well, that is a spiritual blueprint, a map for how we are to deal with any negaim, with any, a nega is like the, when the tzarat is actually on your skin, something is like touched you. But a nega
could be a nega on the house also.
Like, right, but it's some sort of affliction. That's probably the best way to translate the word nega, an affliction that's come upon you. And then when an affliction comes upon you.
Or just contact with the force.
Yeah. So the Midrash says that, you know, when a Jew got tzarat on his home, so the Torah law is you have to actually take out the bricks that the tzarat appeared on, take the bricks out, throw them away, and put in new bricks. And the Midrash says that the Jews actually found the treasures of the Canaanites inside the walls of their homes as they took out the stones of the tzarat. And I'm like, what does that Midrash say? Is that, that doesn't sound plausible. That doesn't sound real. That sounds weird, and I don't understand it. And the Rabbi, the Lubavitcher Rabbi, comes and says, listen to what really is being taught here. That when a Jewish person or a believer has an affliction that comes upon his life, then what he has to do is he's got to break down those walls. He has to like go in and figure out what is going on. Because just like the tzara'at was a supernatural marvel and wonder that appeared on your home, so too, every affliction that happens into your life is a direct relationship that God has with you. And there are two ways that we can experience it. We can say, we can justify it and say, well, it's not really supernatural. There's a lot of ways to understand the sickness that I have. Maybe it's something that I ate that it's now it's on my skin. Maybe it's something I didn't wash myself properly. Maybe it's not really from God. And we can, and the fact is that a Kohen actually needs to come and you need to like, the Kohen needs to actually say, this is tzarat, get out of here. Or no, this is not tzarat. So there were ways to almost justify it being natural and not supernatural, not directly from God. But when we recognize that the afflictions that come upon us are directly from God, and when we break down the walls and we uncover and we sort of do tshuva and we take that either Lashon Hara or whatever thing we have to fix inside ourselves, when we take it down, we find the treasures of the Canaanites in the walls. Already there's like a blueprint, because there are two ways to see this that are not a biblical way of seeing it. One is that affliction comes upon you and it's just nature. Or an affliction comes upon you and no, that's the devil. That's like very Christian. An affliction came, but that was the devil.
That's not a godly
That's not
thing.
God. God doesn't do that. That's the devil. The devil got me on that one. The devil, the demonic forces, it's the evil in the world, not God. That's like not a Jewish way of understanding it. The affliction that comes upon us is an order that we tear down that wall and then find the treasure that was within that challenging time. Because it's those challenging times that actually bring the best good into our lives that we never would have found that treasure had we not broken down that wall. And so all of the afflictions that we have, the purpose of this Torah portion is to give us a spiritual blueprint to know, listen, it appeared on your home, it appeared on your clothes, and now it's on your skin. That's so obviously a guided by God to see that this an affliction directed towards you with a very specific purpose. So too, every affliction that you have is with a very specific purpose. And within every affliction, there's the same walls. And within every wall, there's a treasure.
But there's also a reminder built into it. I don't know if you're familiar with the Midrash. It's a story about this Kohen in the land of Israel that wanted to, he was struggling financially, so he was going to leave the land and go to work somewhere and then bring money back to his family. And he sat down with his wife to teach her all about how to check for tzara'at, because she was going to be taking over for his duties. And he said, well, if the hair on the tzara'at on the body, if it wilts, then it is tzara'at, and if it doesn't, then it's not, because every hair has its own source of nourishment. And if that cell wilts, and his wife said, let me get this straight. You're saying every single hair has its own source of nourishment. So God, who you are a Kohen, a human, a Jew, and God cannot provide for your sustenance. He can do it for every single hair, but not for yours, that you need to get up and leave the land. And he realized she was right, and he did not leave the land. Because that's the whole idea, the recognition that this type of involvement in our lives, from our homes to our clothing to every follicle of hair on our body, it shows the degree to which God cares. The degree that our decisions are truly epic, that the creator of the universe is orchestrating things to such a microcosmic level.
Yeah, beautiful. Because either we can see our lives being guided by a force beyond our own, or we can always justify it. I mean, the Six-Day War happened, 1948 happened. The whole world was astounded in both of those wars. And then in those couple of days, the most secular of the secular said, I'm a religious man today. This is clearly beyond my comprehension. And then as years pass, we start giving it the rational explanations of, no, this is the way the war could have happened, and it happened like this, and here's the stories. And it's a natural instinct of man to not want to see the supernatural in his life. But really, a believer, really a Jew that's living by the Torah, when they see an affliction that comes upon them, we know everything, the good and the bad, is all coming to guide us. It's all coming from above, and it's our job. The challenges that Israel's facing, whether it be from Germany, whether it be from Syria, all of these challenges that Israel is facing, and Israel is overwhelmed with challenges, those aren't curses coming upon us by the devil. On the contrary, those are opportunities that God is giving us to actually find our treasure. It's allowing us to be who we need to be as a nation, as a people. And everyone that's listening to this, all of us, every single person that I've ever met has challenges that are of epic proportions, because this life is a challenging life. We were not put in this world to sit on the beachside and sip martinis. Everyone's life is going to be filled with challenges, but the key of the Torah, the key that the Torah is giving us, don't relegate it to the devil and don't relegate it to chance or nature, but find the divine message within it. And within that divine message, you'll find treasures.
And also, if at this very moment you're not feeling a huge challenge, my advice, my thought is that you should look at the way you're acting, the way you're being at night when you write your journal. Think about your actions and create the challenges for yourself. Because when the Torah says, Vayeshev Yaakov, and Yaakov finally sat down to just to dwell and to be, that's when the whole thing with Joseph started. That's when all of his problems started. It's a fundamental mistake, I believe, to always be seeking serenity. If you have serenity, then find your own way to build your own challenge, to grow and to refine your character.
No, I'm going to have to just challenge that one a little bit. I think serenity is a great thing. But I was just watching this YouTube video on the way here, actually. I was just like pressed play and then was listening to it in the car. And I love listening to people that are excellent. Just hearing their what drives them, what motivates them, how they did it. And there was some sort of thing that popped up on my YouTube thing about Michael Phelps. And he's like the greatest Olympian athlete of all times, won more gold medals than anyone in the history of the Olympics. He's like this epic swimmer, unbelievable guy. And one of the guys asked him, Michael Phelps, how did you do it? And he said, I had a dream to be the greatest swimmer in the history of the world. And for 5 years, I trained and I never missed one day of training. And yeah, of course, there were days that I didn't want to do it. But if you miss one day of training and swimming, it takes 2 days to recover. And I was building on 5 years without missing one day. No one could compete with me because no one was ready to make that kind of commitment. And I said, that doesn't mean that he's not serene. He may be very calm. He may be at peace with himself, but he's determined. He's focused. He wants to accomplish what he wants to accomplish. I mean, I think that's a silly goal. I don't think that anyone else...
That's a silly goal?
A little bit of a silly goal, to dedicate your life to swimming. That's not my thing.
It was a silly goal for you, but for Michael Phelps...
For Michael Phelps, fine. But I think for like a believer, for a Jew, that's just not the right way to be. I don't think you should dedicate your life to swimming. I think it's silly. You should dedicate your life to Israel, to God, to family, to values, to something that's not splashing around in the water. But that's not the point. I enjoy listening to someone that's values are very different than my values, just to understand his mindset. So serenity does not mean don't work hard. you can work hard and find challenges and put goals for yourself, but that doesn't mean you got to be stressed out about it. That doesn't mean you got to freak out about it. But it does mean that if you don't have the challenges and you don't have the goals, then you're going to be put through the ringer, because we are meant here to grow. And if you're not growing on your own, God will grow you.
Right. God will grow you. That's, if there's one thing you and I can both say, and I think many of our listeners would be able to agree with such a thing, because if not, how would they have been drawn to listen to the Land of Israel Network if not from the realization that there's something out there that needs to be tapped into and harnessed and connected with? So all of you, shalom from the hills of Judea. Thank you for listening. Forward this to your family and friends. We're really trying to get this out there. I feel this frustration when I'm in the airport and I meet people and I talk to them and tell them what we're doing. And every once in a while, there's someone that hasn't heard the Land of Israel Network.
I'm like, you haven't heard of it yet? Shocks me each time that happens.
Yeah, yeah. And there's, you know, there's Shlomo Katz, there's Yishai Fleischer, there's Josh Haston, there's Eve Harrow. We got Mike Foyer. We have like such thinkers, such philosophers, such activists. This is really where it's at. And without you guys, we couldn't make it happen. So
take a few minutes and share it on Facebook. Put it out on Twitter. Send it to your friends. Email people. Plug them in. It's a beautiful mitzvah. Make it happen, folks.
Shalom from Judea.
Shalom.
The best place to stay in Jerusalem is Windows of Jerusalem Apartments. Windows of Jerusalem Vacation Apartments offers luxury 5-star short and long-term rental apartments in the heart of Jerusalem city center. Elegant and modern, inviting and comfortable. The view, the location, the great apartments, and the staff will truly make you feel at home in Jerusalem. Book your stay now at windowsofjerusalem.com. That's windowsofjerusalem.com.
Hello, my name is Tommy Waller. I'm the founder and president of HaYovel. More than 12 years ago, I made my first trip to the Land of Israel. What I saw and heard changed my life forever. I stood with Nir Levi, an Orthodox Jewish man in his vineyard in Samaria on the Mountain of Blessing. There he opened his Bible and read the prophecy of Jeremiah that said, "You shall yet plant vineyards on the mountains of Samaria." We have the opportunity to join Israel as it celebrates the 50th year of the liberation of Jerusalem, Judea, and Samaria. Come join us as we witness the unveiling of prophecy in the Jubilee year. Come be a part of the biblical narrative. Go to HaYovel.com, that's HaYovel.com, to find out more. And I hope to see you there.